when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor. For Philip Gould, Andrew Cooper is the best political pollster of his generation. For Jim Messina, he's the worst pollster I have ever worked with. For Douglas Alexander, he's the man who saved the Union, but for Fraser Nelson, he's the man who doomed it. Lord Cooper of Windrush, our guest today on Free Exchange, has been at the heart of some of the biggest campaigns in British politics, on both the winning and the losing side. The co-founder of Populus, he was director of strategy to David Cameron, pollster for the Better Together campaign in Scotland, and for the Remain campaign in the EU referendum. As Britain prepares to go to the polls, we talk to him about the art of polling, the art of campaigning, and what on earth is happening to British politics.
So I mentioned that you've been one of the first Tory modernisers. In fact, there's an argument that you were the first Tory modernizer. As early as 1988, you presented William Hague with research arguing that the Tory party needed to be detoxified, overhauled, modernised, and basically make its peace with the 20th or 21st centuries. In fact, I think you were the first to use the phrase the nasty party.
I don't know if that's true. There are people who tell me that that is the case. I don't particularly claim ownership of that phrase, but that phrase was certainly within the spirit of the analysis that we had. And the challenge, I think, at that point, after that extraordinary evisceration in 1997, was to try to make the party look at itself from the outside in, and to see the Conservative Party through the eyes of the voters and the people who confidently and happily voted Conservative in the past, but suddenly felt that the party was no longer for them. And that phrase, which of course Theresa May then famously used, did capture a lot of what people did think about the party.
But is there an argument that you're effectively the last modernizer as well? That the analysis you had then about how politics works seems to have been overhauled or replaced by a new paradigm post-Brexit?
Well, I mean, at its simplest, I think that the modernising thought is that parties need to be, they need to fit the times. You know, they need to understand and respect the state of the country as it is now and respond to today's challenges. And the fact is that the Brexit vote has changed the political landscape, at least in the short term. And has sort of rotated the axis of politics in a way that the dynamics are different and the coalitions within parties and between parties are different. So it's definitely a different challenge. And I think, you know, the how does the Conservative Party remain contemporary and current and modern and in touch with Britain today remains the challenge. But the answers to that will be very different perhaps than they were when we were looking at the question 20 years ago, after all, after 1997.
And I mean, looking at the election campaign, which is still going on, we're recording a couple of weeks in advance, but looking at the election campaign so far, do you think the Conservatives have got the answers broadly right?
I think strength and stability is clearly a very important part of what the country wants at this point, and I think it's right to emphasise that. Personally, I think that the campaign should have the confidence in the strength of the party's position to manage down expectations a bit, because I think we're going to find in a year or two there's a sort of reckoning that the country may not be ready for. And I think,
is that Brexit related?
I think it's Brexit related. I think that there's just a lot of big challenges in this country. I mean, it's Brexit related, and clearly we don't know how it's going to shake down. And I think at the moment, voter expectations, even people who voted enthusiastically to leave and people who voted to remain, I think expectations are probably unrealistically high about how well the negotiations will go and how painless this may be. But also there are other huge challenges. Obviously, we've got huge challenges in our education system. There are massive problems with the NHS.
The deficit's still there?
The deficit is absolutely still there. So there still isn't any money, as it were. It's a difficult landscape to navigate. And I think that the fact that the Conservative Party is deservedly going to win a massive majority gives the opportunity actually to be a bit more direct with the country, and I think to take the opportunity not to give hostages to fortune on issues like tax and spending and in my personal opinion, immigration policy too.
You gave a talk recently where you said that I think something like 60% of voters thought about the EU, they need us more than we need them. And presumably that's a sort of parcel of the whole.
Yeah, I mean, it was, in my view, that was a critical part of the EU referendum debate, because it enabled people to feel that whatever people said now, which was all about how they wanted to vote in the referendum, the fact that the EU needs us more than we need the EU meant that in the final analysis they'd have to give us a good deal. And I think right through the referendum campaign, from the period of a year and a half up to June 23rd last year, those numbers barely wavered at more than 60%, and I think an awful lot of people still feel that. You know, the anecdotal argument about the boss of BMW going into Angela Merkel and saying, I don't care about your EU level politics, but BMW needs a deal with Britain and she'll have to give them one. I don't think it's going to be as simple and straightforward as that. But a lot of voters feel, if you do focus groups now on this issue, a lot of people are quite bored with the whole subject. It's dominated politics for ages, and as we know, most people aren't interested in politics, really. And a lot of people puzzle why we haven't left already, because it was ages ago and what's going on. There's a vague awareness of a thing called Article 50, but most people don't know what it is or how that works. And there is still that sense that in the final analysis we'll get a good deal, because they need us more than we need them. And also a feeling that because Project Fear, as everybody called it, had said that the sky would come crashing down if we voted to leave, and it hasn't. That's made people feel, I think, probably unduly confident that it's all going to be fine.
I remember a friend of mine saying to me that the greatest cure for sort of Westminsteritis is spending an hour in a focus group and seeing just how little of all the things that we talk about around here gets absorbed.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I've often sat in. I used to, when I worked for David and before, back in the day when I worked for William Hague, I used to try to get politicians to come and watch focus groups, because it's very good for their sense of reality, though incredibly dispiriting if you're the minister who spent weeks going around the TV studios talking about a particular policy, and you then go to focus group and find that not only has no one ever heard of the policy, they've never even heard of you. When I worked in Number 10 for David Cameron, I had on the wall next to my desk a quote from Tony Blair's memoir, in which, and I paraphrase slightly, but he said the biggest mistake that politicians make is massively to overestimate how interested people are in politics. He said that's a fatal error in lots of politicians, and he said the reason why it matters is because it causes politicians too often to focus on the small picture when they should be focusing on the big picture. I think that's an absolute truth in politics, and most people, most ordinary voters are busy getting on with their lives, and they find politics boring and confusing and filter out as much of it as they can.
But when they do take notice, they kind of, it can often be quite a sort of sharp moment for Westminster.
Yes, and I mean, one of the things about election campaigns is that it's a period where even people who are titanically uninterested in politics feel this is the moment I have to engage and get a sense. So you can sort of set and reset people's impressions of parties and their priorities and their leaders and their values at election times.
But one of the things you've said is that you need to do that throughout. It's no good, say, Jeremy Corbyn just coming out now and saying, we're going to close the deficit, we believe in fiscal responsibility.
Precisely because people tune politics out so much, it's vital that the bits and pieces that get through, which is, you know, in peacetime between elections, is often in the form of the, you know, the 40-second soundbite on the 6 o'clock news, but it's little nuggets of, it's like sort of pixels forming a picture, and each little pixel has to add up to a coherent picture. Well, otherwise, it's just fuzz.
I was once told that with Ed Miliband, with David Cameron, it was something like, it was like, you know, hugs hoodies, hugs huskies, posh. With Ed Miliband, it was weird bacon sandwich stamped his brother.
Yeah. And the people, you know, you start from a base where most people never heard of almost any politician, and over time, as they get exposed to them, people end up knowing two or three things, and that's it, that's their capacity. You know, William Hague struggled right from the beginning because most people already knew that he'd given a speech to the Tory conference when he was 16, which marked him out straight away as extremely atypical and weird. And then we added to that almost immediately a baseball cap, and then finally it was capped off with the claim that he drank 12 pints of beer, and there wasn't room for anything else, really.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more interesting things I read in the biographies when I was researching this is that you actually polled on whether the idea of David Cameron as a chillaxer was cutting through, because everyone seemed to be, that was the reputation he was getting in Westminster. So.
Yeah, I think it's natural and right that party leaders, good politicians want to know the kind of unvarnished truth of what voters think of them, and that then feeds into communication strategy. And at that period, there was a lot of sort of insinuation in the press and attacks on Cameron for chillaxing too much, and he wanted to know whether that was cutting through and was that becoming a problem and sort of sapping at his authority as Prime Minister.
So. In the Tory war room at the moment, what sort of things will they be doing on a sort of rolling basis and day to day?
In terms of the research, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know, but I would imagine they'll be doing a lot of tracking polling in sets of specific individual seats to test where they are in terms of the level in the battleground and how messages are landing. They will be doing research to test the impact of different communications. There are lots of different ways of making the same argument. I think we all learned a huge amount from the Barack Obama's 2012 campaign, which was a big sort of step change in campaigning, and the use of social media and the really sort of rigorous multi-level testing of different arguments. In the Obama 2012 campaign, they tested everything sort of 20 times, 20 different versions of a particular piece of communication, and what they discovered was that the managers of the campaign and the politicians never once correctly guessed which would be the most effective.
But of course the new thing now is that you're not just testing 20 messages against the population, you're testing 20 messages or 200 messages against individual segments of the population.
Correct. It's the use of sophisticated data analysis to put voters into buckets, as it were, so that you can hone your message, and even to get to the level of doing that on a probabilistic predictive basis, where you're able to say, we know enough about you that we can say with a fairly high degree of confidence that we think the issues you're concerned about are ABC, not DEF, and that you're prepared to be communicated in this particular way, and therefore to tailor both the message and the mode of communication. And it's not perfectly accurate, but it's much more accurate than going in cold and simply applying the same message to absolutely everybody, which is obviously what you had to do when you didn't have channels by which to target people.
And of course there's an argument that this is not very good for politics in the kind of broader sense, that, you know, instead of having national conversations, national debates, we're getting sort of invisible micro-targeting on Facebook. That's, you know, you yourself were accused, you know, I think the Mail wrote that you a pollster who wouldn't sneeze without consulting a focus group, and so, you know, said that you had this kind of malign influence over David Cameron because you were testing everything and, you know, would only act if the poll said it was a good idea.
I know that is a misrepresentation. I mean, I've always been of the view that any politician who decides what to say and what to believe and what policies to pursue by reference to focus group is going to end in disaster. Because voters, as we were discussing earlier, tend to be so uninterested in politics and to follow it only in the very broadest big picture. If you sit down in a focus group of voters and you probe on particular issues, you will generally find a massive cognitive dissonance, and that people will believe lots of contradictory things at the same time, and also won't hesitate to completely change their mind about something on a dime. So a politician who sort of uses that and sets a position based on that would wouldn't work. And I'm not sure that any politician ever has done that. What I think is vital for politicians is to get a constant sense of how the voters are seeing the country, are feeling about the country, are feeling about the government, are feeling about the changing sort of balance of issues that concern people. Because if that's changing, or if, you know, if we're pursuing a particular policy, but which to our ear sounds like it's coming across clearly, but to their ear isn't coming across at all, or they're hearing things in the way we're describing it, which are making them feel it's wrong, I think we need to know that. And often the insights it's about how do we communicate more clearly what we're trying to say than it is about let's use research to tell us what to do.
Also, for example, from your time in Downing Street, there were occasions like the NHS reforms where you were just like, this has just gone too far, and and there isn't genuine...
Well, I mean, I went to work in Number 10, I started in March 2011, and we'd already passed the sort of point of no return in pursuing those reforms. What the research said is that it was being communicated catastrophically, that almost nobody understood why we were reforming the NHS, particularly since we'd said that we wouldn't. Almost nobody understood what the reforms were meant to achieve. They were very complicated, and therefore we're in a world where, on the one hand, all the doctors and the nurses and all the medical organisations, the Royal Colleges and everybody that people trust on the NHS said, this is terrible. And there's the Conservative Party, which struggles to earn people's trust on that issue, saying, no, trust us, it's great. And that just wasn't going to end well. So what I did when I got there was, with Craig Oliver, was to say we need to try to reset the debate. So we paused the legislative process in order to try to build some alliances within the NHS among professionals, you know, people who were frankly trusted more than we were on the subject, and to try to kind of reset the terms of the debate so that we could get across more clearly an argument about why we were doing what we were doing that would actually resonate with people and make sense.
But then you've got something like gay marriage, where you're effectively, your research presumably shows that the country is just about ready for this. But you're really saying this is the right thing to do, and I think we can sort of get away with doing it, as opposed to the focus groups say people are demanding it. That's a case of belief leading.
But I think that's right. I think the question, if people want to be led by politicians, they want politicians with convictions. I think research can help you sort of order your priorities. They can help in the way that you talk about these things. There was no sort of spontaneous clamour that the country wants action on this. It was certainly clear that from the research that when forced to think about it in a poll or a focus group, on balance, there was a majority that thought, yeah, that's fine.
But quite a lot of hardcore Tory voters.
A lot of Tory voters very resistant to it. I approached it from a different angle, which was actually that David Cameron, long before I had anything to do with David Cameron, had publicly committed himself to it. He personally believed in it very strongly because he believes very strongly in marriage, and he thinks in the nicest possible way that it'd be lovely if everybody could be married as happily as he is. So, and he'd already said that very clearly in when he first became leader, said that what he believed, he supported marriage, whether it between a woman and a woman, or a man and a woman, or a man and a man, and he managed to get a ripple of applause out of a Tory conference for saying that. And the fact was, it was already in the pipeline. So the question was, do we let Tory members of the government who oppose equal marriage block it off in committee, which would have become a row within the coalition, in which the Lib Dems would have been championing it and the Tories would have been seen to be blocking it? Or does David Cameron, who's already told everybody that this is something he believes in, does he take ownership of it and make sure it happens? And my view was that he should do the latter. He believed it was the right thing to do. As it happens, so do I. But it was on the agenda, so it wasn't a question of asserting it, and certainly, you know, none of us thought this was a high priority for the country. It's just something that could quite easily be done. I did think and do think that, particularly when you've got a Conservative government having to take some very difficult and painful decisions to deal with a deficit, leavening people's perception of the party's values by doing some more progressive things is important and necessary, so that there's a or balanced picture of the party and its values, because otherwise the stereotype too readily drops back into place. Before 2010, one of the things we did was in polling, was we frequently asked people in polls the unprompted question, what would be your biggest fear if the Conservatives win and David Cameron to be Prime Minister? And invariably the biggest fear, particularly in the context of the economic debate at the time, was they'll cut much too deeply, and in particular they'll cut the NHS. So taking the necessary difficult decisions that had to be taken on the economy in 2010 to 2015 could easily have reversed the sort of modernisation gain in terms of the perception of the party's value. So I think that the equal marriage helped in that sense. But it is astonishing, you know, that the Tory party got very, very feverish about it. We had all these reports of from cabinet ministers of their local activists resigning and so forth, and lots of people predicting that it would cost us the general election. And as far as I could see it here, when we got to the general election 2 years later, it had already ceased to be an issue. I don't think anybody voted differently. Well, I don't think anybody voted against the Conservative Party in 2015 in any numbers because of equal marriage. And actually, I think one of the great things about Britain and one of the great things about the Conservative Party is how quickly it adapts. And actually, I think people have resettled around that new status quo very easily, because actually it turned out it didn't diminish the meaning of marriage for heterosexual couples, and it's a happy thing.
Moving from happy things and happy couples to slightly harder-edged politics, in the Scottish referendum, what's now called Project Fear, derived from your advice that love-bombing Scotland, that talking about common bonds and these sort of emotional connections wouldn't work, and the focus had to be on independence being irreversible, the economic consequences, that really kind of hard-edged campaign. Do you think that was the right judgment to make?
Well, what the research said to us, which I think everybody found very sobering, was that there was, if you think, Scotland sort of split into three blocks, and there were a group of people who were going to vote for independence come what may. There were a group of people who were going to vote to stay in the union come what may. But the people in the middle are wavering, the floating voters, as it were, of that referendum. When you looked at their attitudes, what we found was that attitudinally, they were much, much, much closer to the people who were definitely going to vote for independence.
They felt that Scottish rather than English.
They felt Scottish rather than English.
British, obviously.
They felt very little affinity with the union. They felt very little affinity with people like them in the rest of the UK. They didn't feel there were any particular advantages to Scotland from being in the United Kingdom. That, you know, their hearts were already a long way to independence. So, the judgment call that the campaign had to make was, in the time we have available, with the resources we have available, is it realistic for us to completely turn around those particular swing voters' feelings about Scotland's relationship with England and the rest of the UK? And the decision we came to was that was not realistic, that actually those views had been developing over a long period of time. I think the lesson here actually is that when the Conservative Party opposed, as it did for a long time, the creation of a Scottish Parliament, its central argument was the Scottish Parliament is a slippery slope towards the independence, and I think that was true. That did unleash that impetus, but nobody really did anything about it. We'd observed it. Then after the Scottish Parliament was set up, I think all of us who believe in the United Kingdom should have been much more actively engaged in campaigning, really continuing to make the case why devolved powers is one thing, but that Scotland still benefits from being in the UK, and that didn't happen. So by the time we get to kind of 2013, in the run-up to the referendum, it was very hard realistically to see how you could recreate in those people this sense of belonging, this sense of value of being part of something bigger, of affinity with the rest of the UK.
And there's an exact parallel here with the EU referendum, where in both cases, at the start of the campaign, it looks like it's going to be an easy win for the status quo, on the surface level of the polling.
I don't think that's quite. I think Scotland, I think Scotland more so than the EU, but I think it's wrong to think that there was complacency in Scotland because when you actually looked at the attitudes, it was really challenging in the sense that they were they almost had one foot down to the door already, and what we're going to have to do, people really liked the idea of independence and how they thought independence would make Scotland.
But that's the parallel I'm making. With the EU, effectively, they really liked the idea of Britain being independent again. And yes, there had been decades in which no one had made any arguments in favour of the EU. Yes. Everyone had blamed Brussels for everything. In your focus groups, you find that when you ask people to say nice things about the EU, tumbleweed rolls across the table, and someone eventually says, "Oh, trade maybe." So your argument then again would be that there was no. You can't start building a positive, optimistic, patriotic case for the EU, to quote Will Straw, in the last sort of weeks and months before the referendum.
That is my view of what the research told us. I wasn't in charge of that campaign. I believed strongly in its argument and I was working for it, but I didn't take that decision, but that was strongly my view. And I think that if we'd spent a year and a half running a campaign about the benefits of the UK and a pro union campaign, I think we may well have lost that referendum, because it wouldn't have been harmful, but it wouldn't have landed. And my view is that in essence, what we were trying to do was to get people to vote against something that they were actually in their hearts in favour of.
And were you surprised by that? What then happened in Scotland after the vote? I mean, for me, it felt like when David Cameron stood up and said, "Oh, and now we need to get a fair deal for the rest of the UK too." That was the moment at which it kind of just went. It sort of crystallised a sort of a phase change, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a mistake, certainly tonally, and it was probably a mistake substantively as well. Scotland needed to be sort of reassured and assured and welcomed back in open arms and get a very positive reaction to its decision. And I certainly think the way that sounded in Scotland was very jarring.
On the EU, one of the criticisms made of you is...
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Is it basically you got the numbers wrong? That I mean, Tim Shipman in his book says, and I quote, the main reason why Stronger In stuck with the failing strategy was Andrew Cooper's polling. On the final day of the poll, Populus, which you're part of, has remained 10 points ahead. And in fact, in the 2015 UK election, you give Cameron a 0.5% chance of securing an outright majority, which then actually happens. Yep. I mean, is there? I suppose the way you, what good is a pollster if the polls are not working?
I take that entirely on the chin. I mean, let's take that in order in chronological. So, I mean, 2015. What we tried to do Because if you think about it, in a country where actually who governs the country and by what, you know, what authority is about how many MPs you end up with, not what your share of the vote is. And yet what the common currency through the campaign is what percentage of supporters each party have. So what we tried to do in 2015 was to develop a model which transposed poll numbers into not only seats in parliament, but probabilities of particular governmental outcomes. And if the poll numbers had been right, we would have been right that with the numbers that we were looking at, that there was a very, very, very slender chance, probability, of there being a Conservative government with a majority. If you put the correct election figures into that prediction model, it produces the right numbers. So the problem wasn't the... I know that some people are particularly galled by that, and I think it sort of saw it as sort of hubristic, spurious specificity. If you, as it were, sort of follow the Watergate deep throat principle of following the money, what commentators should have noted was that you, in past elections, you knew there was an election going on because everywhere you went, there were huge billboards everywhere, and there were virtually none in 2015. So I posed the question, they're not spending all their money on posters, what are they spending it on? And that while Ed Miliband boasted about his millions of conversations, I said, what the Conservatives are doing is silently and crucially invisibly targeting the key voters who matter with the key messages. That's where their money is going. And it may well be that at the end of all of this, we find that actually that makes the difference and that means that they win. And I also said, and the reason why that may be the case is because ultimately the country prefers the Conservatives on the economy and strongly prefers David Cameron to Ed Miliband. And those in an election that nobody feels very enthused about may be the thing that defines it. So I, in common with almost everybody else, I misread and underestimated the chance of the Conservatives winning outright because the polls were wrong.
And why were the polls wrong?
The polls were wrong because two big problems. Firstly, there's a fundamental underlying question of challenge of the representativeness of samples. So when I first started doing opinion polling, the gold standard was you did it on the phone. The response rate was about 1 in 5, so to get a 1,000 sample, you talked about 5,000 people. You could easily do that over the course of a weekend, and that's what we used to do when we did polling for the Times. Response rates on the phone have collapsed, so they're now more like 1 in 20 or 1 in 25. You know, I'm sure that you don't know very many people who use a landline, and I'm sure you know even fewer people who readily answer calls from people they don't know anymore.
I think the only reason people have landlines anymore is so that they can get broadband.
Yeah, so you can no longer do, or you can, it's become much, much harder and much more expensive to do a traditional random digit dial probability sample on the phone. And the economics of the industry have driven people more and more to online panel polling. But the problem with online panels is they don't capture the full spectrum of the demographics of the country. And in particular, they have not enough people on internet panels to be polled who are time-poor, professional, middle-class people.
Or elderly people who don't really use the internet.
They have some of those, but that's another issue with polling, because if you've got a small number of 75-year-old people in your online panel, what you do with that as a policy in order to make them representative within the overall sample is you have to upweight them, and therefore what you're doing is assuming that the 75-year-old person who is on your internet panel is attitudinally similar to one who isn't, which is clearly highly unlikely to be true, and in as much as they therefore may be atypical of their age range, what you're doing is actually magnifying the error because you're having to upweight them.
So it's the John Curtis point that it wasn't shy Tories, it was busy Tories.
Yes. And that's problem one is representation. Problem two is, which is a constant challenge for pollsters, is estimating who is going to vote. In general terms, people massively overestimate their own probability of voting and are very poor at estimating their likelihood to vote. So if we're starting off with a sample of 2,000 people, almost all of whom say, yeah, I'm definitely going to vote.
Especially the younger ones.
But we know only 65-70% of them will actually vote. Which 65-70% will actually vote makes a vast difference when party shares are relatively close together. And the tendency within the polling industry has been to move towards what they call propensity models, which is basically looking at demographic patterns of past elections and applying a turnout propensity to people based on their demographics rather than on how likely they say they are to vote. But that obviously is built on the premise that the demographics of a voting electorate will be pretty similar from one election to the next, and that wasn't right.
And was this the problem with the Brexit campaign? Because all of a sudden you're going from a campaign in which you know what the electorate looks like, you know how people have behaved in the past, to one where there's effectively no precedent.
Yes, and I mean, general elections, they are cluttered with issues and people having to weigh up lots of different, sometimes competing factors about parties. Referendums declutter and you have a simple kind of binary question and it draws out a different electorate. Now, in the EU referendum, we in common with most other pollsters, have done a lot of work post-2015, very frankly trying to address the problems that we had and trying to come up with methodologies which would cope with those issues, and that's where we're going into the EU referendum. Now, in the EU referendum turnout terms, we expected the turnout to rise from the general election level as it did, and we expected that there would be an increased turnout among poorer, less well-educated blue-collar workers who feel very strongly about the EU. But we also expected there to be an increase in turnout among 18 to 30-year-olds who felt strongly about the EU. And though we assumed that the former group would be more numerous, because the ratio among that group on the EU was something like 60-40 for Brexit, whereas the ratio among the younger people was more like 80-20 for Remain, that it would roughly sum out, and that therefore that in higher turnout, in terms of the referendum debate, it would be roughly a wash.
And instead you get to this turnout threshold, which I think Leave say they knew about, but which is where it gets to sort of around 70% or over. Yeah. Suddenly you get all these people voting who've never voted before, pouring out of the council estates.
And with hindsight, that is where the polls went wrong. But I mean, there was evidence to sort of back up our thesis when we looked at the demographic profile of the people who applied to go onto the electoral register in order to vote. It was very heavily skewed younger people. The incidence of 18 to 34s among those new registrants was more than twice what it is in the population. So that gave us reassurance that those people, young people, were actually going to do what they say they're going to do. And actually what happened is a lot of young people joined the register and then didn't vote. And that the 2.8 million people who voted in the referendum who hadn't voted in the general election the year earlier were very disproportionately Leave voting people.
I mean, do you think it could have been that there was a case for going harder at Boris and Gove and sort of tying them to Farage and really kind of, you know, and basically sacrificing Tory unity for the sake of referendum victory? So I mean, there's two arguments on that. One, which I think is yours, is that the more people saw this on blue and blue as blue on blue, the more they just washed their hands of the whole thing. But there's another argument, which is that, you know, you needed Labour voters to vote, and
I agree. I mean, the Labour campaign was a huge problem, and you know, I mean, I know that the Labour colleagues in that in the Remain campaign found Corbyn's office actively obstructive, not just sort of passively unhelpful. I mean, there was a proper debate about that. I mean, you know, David Cameron and George Osborne were strongly opposed to blue on blue. My concern was that, because of the way that the campaign is reported, if David Cameron had attacked Boris Johnson, that what would have come through in the news, dominated the news, would have been the blue on blue and the sort of pantomime within the Tory party, rather than the substantive argument. So I don't know. What I did advocate was that which I guess probably would have taken us into that territory, is we were increasingly concerned by the potency of £350 million for the NHS, which people were spontaneously quoting back in focus groups in a world where most ordinary people don't know any statistics about anything. And I did argue that actually maybe it was time to just take that head on and you know, try to establish in people's minds that actually that figure isn't true. And if that's not true, what else that they're telling you isn't true either?
Well, there was that extraordinary press conference where Cameron stands in Downing Street and basically just accuses everyone of lying. It's a sort of, you know, just clearly a man at the end of his tether who hasn't found a way of
Yeah, I mean, I said in Craig Oliver's book, he quotes me as saying that you know, a simple lie beat a complex truth, and I mean that I think is how a lot of us felt in the campaign, and I think, you know, there's a feeling that £350 million was which they stuck to with admirable strategic discipline, but was very cynical.
I mean, do you think winding the clock back, was there a way for you to have won that campaign? I mean, obviously, it was only 52-48, so obviously,
yeah.
Obviously there was. But, yes, obviously but to have won it by the amount that populists thought you were going to win it by.
Well, I'd like to address that point directly, if I may.
Sure.
Because I mean, it's absolutely true that on referendum day, populists published a referendum poll that had a 10% win for Remain. And that was the first populist published since the 2005 election, and probably the last. That was done on a completely different methodology from the research we were doing for the campaign. And you know, we take responsibility for the fact that we published a poll based crucially wrong because the turnout assumptions were wrong. But it is completely wrong to interpret what the campaign was seeing through that poll.
So this was a populist poll, not an Andrew Cooper poll, and the Andrew Cooper polls were going to...
No, I mean, the campaign research was done by populists as well, but using a completely different methodology. We were doing a daily tracking poll for the last 5 weeks of the campaign on a different methodology with different weighting assumptions. But the point of the tracking research in the campaign isn't so much to try to replicate each day what we think would definitely happen if the referendum was today. It's more to make sure we feel we've got an accurate pulse on the movements and the fluctuations and the trajectory. And what that told us was that we could see that beneath the surface we were losing ground on the core arguments, and the economic perceptions were shifting from our side of the argument to theirs. But we also could see that it was very, very close. I mean, you said earlier that, you know, comparing Scotland and the EE referendums, that, you know, we started off with a big lead. Actually, when the first poll we did back in April 2015, the unmodelled numbers was 53-47 to Remain. And once we put in some different assumptions on turnout, you could quite easily see how you, when we ended up in that presentation on having shown how Leave could win 51-49. So it was very close. And again, we knew that there was a softness within it because there were a lot of people who were at that moment saying, yes, I'll probably vote to Remain, but who also had a strong antipathy to the EU and whose hearts quite strongly said, I think we should leave. And that meant that we were vulnerable. And though we thought we'd win, I think we were very alive to the possibility that we could lose. And the campaigns, the daily tracking, we had Leave and Remain basically, well, you know, within the margin of error of 50-50 for about the last 3 weeks. There was a blip, which I think it was also seen in the public polling. I don't know if it was in the Leave's polling, when the awful murder of Joe Cox, there was a blip up for Remain. But that was starting to come out of the system again on Tuesday.
So where did the 60-40 come from? And why publish it?
What 60-40?
So not 60-40, so the 10-point...
We've got a small team of people working with the Remain campaign during Remain's polling. You've got the broader picture of whether populists will re-enter the game of public polling, and did a standalone poll on the Tuesday and the Wednesday before, and you know, the numbers are the numbers. We crunch the numbers. We apply the turnout adjustment, which we think is likely, and that's what we ended up with. It wasn't miles worse than others. There were several which were 54-46 for Remain, but it clearly it was wrong. But it was. I mean, that's.
So going back to the other question, I mean, what would or could or should you have done differently in the campaign?
Well, I think had the renegotiations perhaps been approached and pitched in a different way, we might have had more to work with. I think that with hindsight, we should have tried to make the economic argument in a different way. But you know that it isn't easy. I mean, you know, £350 million, that specific figure is in my view a cynical sort of misrepresentation of a broad fact. But there is a broad fact that it costs us hundreds of millions of pounds a week. There was no simple equivalent fact that captured what is the economic benefit that we assert of us being in the EU. There were lots of sort of estimates, and the CBI had a figure of £3,000 a year for a typical family, but people would say, well, I've never had £3,000 check from the EU. So it was quite hard to sort of bring to life. And in the end, the obvious ways to bring it to life were either through the observations and of experts, of whom it turned out we were all sick and tired, but to try to use the Bank of England, the IMF, the World Bank, you know, people, respected institutions, to say there really is an economic risk, or specific people. And then the other option was to try to produce Treasury numbers that tried to capture for people its view of the scale of the risk. And so you had the
4,300,
but I mean, the problem with that was it didn't feel remotely credible to people. Sounded really, really weirdly high to a person on an average income. Again, people said, "Well, I've never had that from the EU. What are they talking about?" We didn't succeed in kind of crystallising in a credible way for people why that would flow, because they could easily default back to the theory. But the negotiations are going to be okay. They want to trade with us, and they need us more than we need them. So why would that happen? It was also weirdly specific in a world where actually our bigger picture argument was the reason it's risky is because it's a leap into the unknown. Well, if it's unknown, how can you know that it's £4,300? And then, in a sense, we doubled down on that mistake with the prospect of the emergency budget, and it sounded sort of too big, and therefore sounded like scaremongering. And rather than building the credibility of our economic argument, I think it undermined it. But in an ideal world, one would have found a way to, in a relatable way, talk to people about the economic risk to them and their families and the things that matter to them. But actually, in practice, that is hard. And I've got, I frequently talk to people who say, looking back on it now, post-Trump, and looking at the underlying demographics of it, maybe Britain was always going to vote to leave, and maybe we were never going to win. And I agree with you, in any race which ends up 52-48, that by definition means you could have won. But if the young people who signed up the register to vote had voted, we would have won. So, finally,
you talked earlier about the sort of shifting nature of politics, sort of certainly post Brexit, and what we're seeing in this election. I mean, what, if from your position, given that you're doing all this research and you're sort of seeing all this data, what would you say are the sort of defining nature of how British politics is changing? What are the new tribes or groups or attitudes that politicians will have to come to terms with in the next few years?
I mean, the big change, I think, over the last few years has been the growing potency of identity as a political driver, and the growing importance of diversity. And I tend to agree with the way that Tony Blair frames it, which is, I mean, it's an oversimplification, but he said, the political divide is increasingly not left or right on economic terms. It's actually open versus closed. And I think that...
Or the anywhere versus somewhere argument.
Yes. And I think that history, will look back on this period from sort of 1990 to 2040, has the reaction to globalisation and the weighing up of whether globalisation is worth it, whether the price of it is too high for particularly less well educated, less well off people in developed economies. I think that liberal metropolitan, highly educated people on high incomes approve of globalisation for two reasons, partly because they've benefited from it, and partly because it has transformed the lives of billions of people who are living in starvation. But if, I think that, so in effect what we're saying is globalisation has enabled a wealth transfer from the developed economies to the developing ones, and the people who've paid the economic cost of that aren't people like me. They're not the Remain voting metropolitan establishment. They're working class people who've seen their jobs go through globalisation, who've seen their living standards stagnate or fall as a result of it, and who felt voiceless, who felt that their feelings weren't understood or listened to or respected, who for a long time had heard politicians try to make them feel as if the politicians understood their point and promising to do things about it, and then nothing ever seemed to change. And in the end, voting for Brexit, like voting for Trump, felt like a very direct and straightforward way to try to deal with those issues.
But there's an irony here, isn't there, that you sort of spent your career trying to effectively drag the Tory party towards those Remain voting metropolitans, because that was what you needed to do to win elections. And now, almost accidentally, it's found itself in this position where it's the voice and spokesman and sort of standard bearer for the people who've been left behind.
Yes, and I think it needs to be very careful about that. I think at the moment we're in a fortunate position where there isn't any credible alternative, and the Conservative Party can take with it a lot of Remain supporting people who would favour a much more open rather than closed view of the world. But ultimately, you can't holding both sides of that together is going to be very difficult. I also think there's a question, underlying question here, which is, do we really believe that leaving the EU and, let us say, if we do, taking back control of our borders and reducing immigration, do we really believe that is actually going to improve materially the lives and opportunities and prospects and prosperity of poor, low-skill, working-class people in economically disconnected parts of Britain? And I think the answer to that is clearly no. Now, if you look at Clacton, which obviously was the one UKIP seat, had one of the biggest majorities for Brexit, which is 99% white, has no EU migration to speak of whatsoever. Is Clacton going to find its trajectory turned and suddenly see more positive future of itself because of Brexit? No.
But you can make the argument that, as David Goodhart does, that British firms have preferred to recruit foreign labour rather than training up British labour, so that there's an indirect effect of immigration as well as the whole pressure on public services point.
That may be true to an extent. I mean, that's certainly not what businesses and industries say is their experience with the British labour market. But I think if our reaction to that is to basically shut our doors, I think that's a pretty dispiriting response from us as a country. And when I worked for David Cameron, one of the moments that I was most satisfied by it was the 2012 party conference speech, in which he set out the argument that the bigger context for having to fix the deficit is that we're in a global race.
William Hague's phrase, I believe.
There was a meeting in the cabinet room and he went around the table and it was William's frame. But it's a slightly clunky phrase, but, you know, and obviously what it's talking about is globalisation. But what we found when we researched it is even people who find it extremely challenging and unwelcome mostly accepted that it was true. So that actually, you know, we've opened up the global economy and in the era of the internet, you can't really close it again, even if you wanted to, however challenging the consequences. And the idea that by a few small, simple steps or by shutting our doors, we can insulate ourselves from the pressures and tides of a global economy just isn't true. And so, you know, in the Cameron speech, in a global race, what we have to do is make sure that we're competitive and highly skilled and able to compete and thrive and lead in a global race, not pretend that we don't have to engage with it. Brexit doesn't actually make any of those things go away. In policy terms, that certainly means that education and training and retraining and upskilling become incredibly important. If you look at the demographics of the people who were the core of the vote to leave the EU, they're by and large the same people who are going to be facing the particular pressure of job losses through automation and robotics and AI. So there's a sort of second wave coming there, and it's going to make the need to reskill and upskill even more urgent.
So we need to build a country that works for everyone, or else.
Yes, I think that's right, and I think we need to connect places. I think it's not a coincidence that many of the most strongly Brexit supporting places are seaside towns, literally at the periphery, at the edge of our society, that are physically, literally, very disconnected from where the kind of engines and economic hubs are of a modern globalised economy. I was looking the other day, if you compare Brighton and Margate, two southern seaside towns, both about 70 miles from London. One voted massively for Remain, one voted massively for Leave. And you look at the differences between them. You know, Brighton is a young place, much younger than the population as a whole. It's very diverse. It's better educated and better off. I think very significantly, it's less than an hour from London by train.
I was going to say that for
90 quid a week. Margate, which is older, poorer, less healthy, less well educated, and is there's no proper direct reach, and it's getting on for 2 hours, and it costs getting on for 200 quid a week. I don't think that's a coincidence. So, you know, a response to the pressures of globalisation on people who felt drawn to the apparent simplicity of Brexit is, for example, let's invest in the high-speed rail links connecting Margate to London, and you turn it into a London commuter town, and suddenly, in a world where we need to build hundreds of thousands of houses, if we build some of them in Margate, what we're going to get is young families wanting to live in that area, needing to live in that area, and suddenly you start rejuvenating those places and bringing a bit of economic vitality and you know, literally reconnecting them to the motors of a modern economy, which in the UK is a lot of that is about the big cities, and that's where the networks and the opportunities are.
So effectively trying to turn Leave voters into Remainers, or kind of socially speaking.
I mean, I say my personal view is that I don't believe that the Leave proposition was correct, in that it isn't actually going to solve the problems that those people hoped that it would. And so our challenge is not to sort of have any, we should only have respect for the life experiences which drew people to that conclusion. But if it's true that Brexit isn't actually going to be the answer, we need to focus really hard on what is the answer then. And I certainly think that if we are headed for a world in which it's an open versus closed debate, people who are, as it were, on the open side of that argument need to have a much more positive and coherent response to the very real feelings and experiences of people who were drawn to the closed argument. Because I don't think that the closed argument is tenable. I don't think it's right, and it's certainly not where I personally want to be in political terms.
Lord Cooper, thank you very much. And if you enjoyed this, please subscribe on iTunes or any other podcast service, or review and rate and let us know what you think. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.